all rise.
Please be seated. We'll hear argument in 19-802, Richards versus State Farm Lloyds.
May it please the court. Mr. Knight will present argument for appellants. Appellants have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. There is nothing exceptional, unique, or out of the ordinary about the language that State Farm used in its policy of insurance. For that reason, the principal issue that the appellants have emphasized in their briefing, and that I will focus on this morning, is the inherently flawed proposition that characterizes State Farm's argument, which is that that policy somehow is so unlike any other policy of insurance that has come before this court in more than half a century, since this court in Hayden Newport versus Southern General formally recognized the Eight Corners Rule, that State Farm's policy and only State Farm's policy should be accepted from the operation of the rule. Not only is that proposition inherent to State Farm's argument, it is frankly framed by the extremely narrow question certified from the Fifth Circuit, which is whether or not this court will recognize a policy language exception articulated in B-Hall, which is to say whether or not the court will accept from the operation of the Eight Corners Rule a policy of insurance that omits the groundless, false, or fraudulent coverage provision, as State Farm's policy unquestionably does. Which begs the question, does the omission of that clause make the policy so unlike any other policy, homeowners insurance, commercial general liability insurance, that this court has considered in more than half a century to justify distinctive treatment of that policy? The pattern of this court's jurisprudence respectfully suggests that could not possibly be the case. We have in our brief identified what we consider to be the 13 cases that have come before this court, again, in that more than half a century, wherein the application of the Eight Corners Rule was either directly at issue or at minimum meaningfully addressed by the court with respect to whether or not it applied to the policies that the court was considering. This is the tally as far as how those cases break down in relationship to the language that was included in the respective policies. In 4 of the 13 cases, the appellants, in reviewing the intermediate appellate court rulings, the briefings either in the intermediate appellate courts or the opinion of this court, have determined 4 of those policies omitted the groundless, false, or fraudulent coverage provision. King v. Dallas, 2002. Zurich versus Nokia, 2008. Pine Oaks v. Great American Lloyds, 2009. And Ewing Construction versus Amerisure, 2014. If the groundless, false, or fraudulent coverage provision was the sine qua non of the Eight Corners Rule, we cannot explain what this court did in those cases. In addition to those 4 cases, 4 additional cases that I think are significant. National Union Fire versus Merchants from 1997, Evanston Insurance Company versus Autofina from 2008, D.R. Horton versus Markle from 2009, and Evanston Insurance Company versus Legacy in 2012. In those cases, the appellants attempted to identify anywhere, intermediate appellate court here again, briefing in the intermediate appellate court, the briefing in this court, this court's opinion in those four cases, whether or not anyone even attributed enough importance or regard to the presence or the absence of the groundless, false, or fraudulent coverage provision to cite to any of the courts, either of the courts below or this court, whether or not it was present or absent from the policy. And no one thought to do so. That, we think, is absolutely, here again, incompatible with the notion that the Eight Corners Rule evolved specifically to address, or that anyone has perceived or understood the rule to be confined to those policies.
Is your understanding that we are here today only about the duty to defend and the Eight Corners Rule?
Yes, but even more narrowly.
Not any duty to indemnify.
Of course, the lower court, the federal district court, ruled that he could preemptively address the duty to indemnify based upon the court's understanding that there is no duty to defend. So it is tied up in that sense, that the same reasons that we did not prevail on the duty to indemnify relate were the basis for his ruling on the duty to defend.
But if it were the other way, if the district court were to rule or the Fifth Circuit were to rule that there were a duty to do it, to defend, that wouldn't necessarily mean that there would be a duty to indemnify.
That is correct. This court's precedent, as I understand it, makes clear that there is a difference between the duty to defend and the duty to indemnify, and just because you have one, you don't have the other. But I also think that that is significant for another reason, with respect to how it is that we assess whether or not there is a duty to indemnify. One of the rationales offered by the Federal District Court in B. Hall was that based upon his understanding of the import associated with the omission of the groundless, false, or fraudulent clause, that in essence closed the gap between the duty to defend and the duty to indemnify. The court's rationale, therefore, was you can rely upon extrinsic evidence before the underlying suit is adjudicated to completion to resolve the duty to defend. The problem with that is this court's standalone doctrine that you cannot resolve the duty to indemnify prematurely. So if all that happens by the exclusion of that clause is that the defense duty and indemnity duty align, there's an independent doctrine that still says State Farm cannot do as it did here to rely upon extrinsic evidence prematurely to resolve either. With respect to, I want to comment, if I may, upon five additional cases, because I mentioned there were 13 that have come before this court. In the final five cases, those policies did indeed include the groundless, false, or fraudulent coverage provision. But what I think is nonetheless significant in that regard is not even in those cases did the court suggest that the presence of that policy language was somehow material to the operation of the Eight Corners Rule. So just looking at the pattern and the practical import, if you will, of what we have seen this court do with respect to prior policies, not at all materially different, if at all different from State Farm's policy, I think that this certified question would have to be answered in the negative. But there is something that I think is equally important in that regard. State Farm in his briefing has suggested that perhaps this is just owed to some kind of passive phenomena. That along this half-century journey, if someone just would have mentioned to a court, this court, an intermediate appellate court, that this language somehow made a difference, we would not be in the current predicament. Well, not even that is accurate. Because in Zurich versus Nokia, as we have briefed, one of the litigants, the Federal Insurance Company, in their briefing to this court, specifically argued that the absence of that clause should be treated as material with respect to the operation of the Eight Corners Rule. And what's, I think, even more so consequential in that regard is the fact that Zurich versus Nokia was a 2008 case. The Federal District Court first proposed this policy language-based exception based upon the omission of that policy language in 2006, such that the Federal Insurance Company did not just argue in the abstract that the absence of that policy language made a difference. Federal Insurance Company specifically cited back to the 2006 ruling from the Federal District Court as its justification for that argument. Yet in Zurich versus Nokia, issued in 2008, as this court had done for almost 40 years to that point, and has continued to do for more than a decade since, the court applied the eight corners rule without differentiation or without regard to the policy language, bearing out that there's nothing exceptional or unique about this particular policy to warrant any different treatment.
Would the policy provide that we will not defend an affirmative statement, we will not defend frivolous claims?
Could a policy provide that? I think that certainly a insurer could draft a policy contemplating that, and of course, as we've briefed, there is a fairly comprehensive regulatory process that the insurer would have to go through for it to be approved. But I appreciate that question, Your Honor, because it actually relates to the second point that I'd like to make, which is, as an initial matter, we think based upon the patterns, course, jurisprudence, stare decisis takes care of this. The settled expectations of the insurance community, of the insured community, and dare I say even the courts, is that this language does not matter. But if we are going to go further and address this notion of whether or not an insurer in theory could draft a policy to somehow account for this parade of horribles that State Farm has briefed and that the amici seem to suggest necessarily follow from the very disciplined way in which this court has recognized unflinchingly and applied the eight corners rule. Well, maybe there is a way that that can be accounted for, but that burden should be upon the insurer to simply draft a policy that accomplishes what the insurer claims and what State Farm here purports to want to accomplish.
If the circuit doesn't ask us this question, obviously, but the parties have argued about whether there should be an exception for extrinsic evidence relevant only to coverage and not to the merits. Tell us your view on that.
I agree. I think the dispositive issue in that regard is that the circuit court did not request guidance from this court. And as we briefed, I think that the reason the circuit court, and I don't want to be too presumptuous, obviously, did not request any guidance in that regard is because we exhaustively briefed and argued precisely that issue to the circuit court. Our position was, assume for the sake of argument, that there is an exception as articulated in Nokia or as one of the amici has suggested that perhaps this court's ruling in Pine Oaks contemplated a slight variation of the exception. The position that we took with the Fifth Circuit was, assume all of that is true, and now let's talk about the facts of record. The facts of record will not allow State Farm in the court that has the only authority to consider factual issues to prevail under either of those variations of a putative exception. That's why we respectfully think this Fifth Circuit did not include that issue within its certification request. Hence, we don't think the court should take that issue up in this matter because it's tied up with factual considerations before that court.
Can I try and just simplify this to get your position? So it's your position that if you have a written insurance policy that expressly says the insurer will defend even against groundless, false, or fraudulent claims, then obviously the duty to defend comes under the eight corners, right?
I agree with that.
Next category, you have an insurance policy, which I think is the question here, that doesn't say anything about whether they'll defend against groundless, false, or fraudulent claims, and your position is eight corners rule applies, they must defend. And then the chief's question is, what if you've got one that says insurer need not defend against a groundless, false, or fraudulent claim? And I wasn't sure how you answered that question.
I don't think that that would be sufficient either, Your Honor, because that still invites ambiguity with respect to how the insurer is going to deal with extrinsic evidence. There is a way to write a policy.
So in other words, that what I just quoted wouldn't be enough to justify looking to extrinsic evidence to decide whether it's groundless, false, or fraudulent.
That is correct, yes.
Okay.
And it certainly would not, because that's not, in any event, what State Farm did here. State Farm did not rely upon extrinsic evidence or argue that the extrinsic evidence demonstrated that the underlying claims were groundless, false, or fraudulent. So that's problematic in itself and another fact issue, but your question is, I think, very astute in that regard, because what State Farm did was to assume, for the sake of argument, because it is true, that there's substantive merit to the underlying claim and that the underlying claims are not fabricated in the sense of being false and fraudulent, but then State Farm submitted extrinsic evidence because they doubt the coverage import of the truthful factual averment in the underlying matter, which has absolutely nothing to do with the contractual import associated with the clause that speaks to groundless, false, or fraudulent claims. In summary, as far as my opening is concerned, we think that stare decisis should take care of this case, but if the court is going to consider some type of contract-based mechanism to avoid these issues, the problem here is that State Farm did not draft the policy to accomplish that. Any other questions?
Just one, if I may, yes, Chief. You were about to tell us what how the insurance company could draft language that would bring extrinsic evidence in, and how would they do that?
I would say, notwithstanding the operation of the Eight Corners Rule in this state, the insurer hereby reserves the right to rely upon extrinsic evidence to evaluate his duty to defend. And there may well be more artful ways of saying that, but why not just say it and go seek Texas Department of Insurance approval instead of saying the omission of a clause that no one has ever thought was important somehow gets you there? Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Knight. We'll hear from the respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Schultz will present argument for the appellees.
May it please the court. The great question before this court is, what is the source of the Eight Corners Rule? That is the ultimate question here. And the reason why I place it in that context is rather simple. This court has consistently relied upon the freedom of contract. That's what the insurance contract comes from. It is the right to agree to assume certain risks in exchange for a premium. What is happening here is that an extra contractual rule is now being applied that is saying that State Farm can't bring in evidence that goes to whether or not exclusions apply. There's nothing in this contract that has any basis for doing so. So what is the purpose of this rule? From where does it come? The real way to answer this is that what we should look to is the contract and the history of that contractual language. And let's start with the case of Moritz. In Moritz, this court adopted an underlying opinion from the Austin Court of Appeals, and in so doing, it said the Austin Court of Appeals said that the fact that there was a groundless coverage clause, a groundless suit clause, meant that the duty to indemnify was larger than the duty to defend. I'm sorry, the duty to defend was larger than the duty to indemnify. That language was the foundation of why this court has adopted the Eight Corners Rule. But somewhere, as the cases have gone on, the rule has been repeated enough that it is now apparently going to apply outside of the contract. There is
you said going to apply, but I think counsel pointed out that there have been several cases that have applied the Eight Corners Rule, even though the policy at issue in those cases, in each of those cases, did not contain this language.
With regard to that, I am somewhat uncertain. I will admit that the cases do not immediately make clear whether or not there was coverage in that way. But I would also point out that I don't believe that this issue has ever been squarely brought before the court, that what the contract says, the language within it, has ever been asked when it's not present. This hasn't been relied upon so far as I can tell, and certainly so far as the Fifth Circuit can tell.
But the duty to defend in your contract doesn't say contingent on a showing that no exclusion to coverage applies.
No, Your Honor. Our contract
just says duty to defend.
It says that there is a duty to defend if coverage applies in this case.
Well, no, it says duty to defend if a claim is made for damages to which this coverage applies.
That's correct.
And that, I think, is the genesis of the Eight Corners Rule, which is the claim is made for damages to which coverage applies. It may be that factually the damages, the coverage doesn't actually apply to these damages, but the claim is that they do. Isn't that kind of the analysis that gave rise to all this in the first place?
I don't think so. I think that under Moritz and the cases following it, the language that was present, that there was a groundless suit clause, expanded the duty to defend past the duty to indemnify. I think that our contract language, as it is written, without the groundless suit provision, makes this contract that the duty to defend does not extend past the duty to indemnify.
But there's a difference between a provision that says State Farm must provide a defense if coverage applies, as opposed to State Farm must provide a defense if a claim is made for damages to which coverage applies. You don't think there's a difference between those two?
I do not think that there's a difference between those two, because I believe that under our policy, the duty to indemnify and the duty to defend are of the same size. I think that if there had been a groundless suit provision included, that would have extended the duty to defend beyond the duty to indemnify, as was happening in Moritz. The flip of this is, of course, one can look to an earlier case that comes up, Birch. In the Birch matter, the trial court did allow for testimony. It looked far past the Eight Corners and took testimony as to whether or not a wife was part of the household of a husband, and then coverage was allowed or not allowed. This court affirmed that decision. That's 3 years after the Hayden case. The point of this and the structure of this is that this court has not been as consistent as appellant would say. While the Eight Corners Rule has been cited repeatedly, this particular issue and this language has not been brought before the court, at least not squarely. In Birch, the matter was raised because it was certainly brought in after the Hayden's Eight Corners Rule.
You know, there are a lot of generally applicable common law rules that we apply as generally applicable, even though their origins are obscure. And if you look back and thought about where they came from, you might find that they don't fit very well with this case, but we apply them as general rules, and courts treat them as general rules just for out of convenience and precedent, and parties can contract around them. Should we always, anytime we're confronted with a rule like that, do we always need to go back to its original origins and divine whether or not the justifications that gave rise to the rule originally exist in the present case? I mean, that would be an awful lot of work, you know, every time we're asked to apply this kind of a common law doctrine.
It is a lot of work, but I do, there's two aspects to this. First, I agree with you that there should be, the fundamental question is whether or not a policy can exclude the Eight Corners Rule. And I think that there must be at least some theoretical policy where that is permitted.
Consider that a separate question.
But on the question of how does one interpret one of these rules that has built up this way, the rule extends as far as its underlying reason. Where that reason ends, the rule has to end. That's the common law. If you change that, what you are saying is that precepts that were laid down, whose origins are now obscure, will not apply. We will apply them blindly. That can't be what we're trying to do here.
What if the main reason is that it's easy to apply? It's simple, it's straightforward, an easy rule to apply as a matter of policy.
If the basic reason is that what is going to always be is that we are going to apply the simplest rule in a particular case, this is the simple rule and we will apply it, I would argue that that's not what the common law holds. If the answer is this is simple, we're always going to apply it, even if it results in an unjust outcome.
Well, because you have
So many different scenarios, just a car accident case. You know, my Safe Harbor, if the Safe Harbor is my auto policy, I had that policy, and somebody's, Justice Lerman sued me for having causing a wreck that injures her. And so I go to my State Farm and say, well, are you going to defend me or not? Says no, because it turns out Justice Blacklock was the one that was involved.
But, for example, in this case, imagine that you had a policy that said, we do not cover an accident which occurred outside of Texas or in Mexico. And it turns out that the accident that you've been sued for was in Mexico. The rule that's being applied here is that State Farm cannot point to the pleadings and say, oh, look, this accident happened in Mexico. And look at what happened under these facts, Your Honor. Under these facts, originally there was a pleading that said where the accident occurred, and it is clear from the exclusions that if the accident occurred off the premises, there is no coverage.
Falls within the eight corners, right? There's no duty to
but then what happened was that there was an amendment. The petition was amended once we had denied coverage to now say simply drop where the accident happened, creating this ambiguity. The ambiguity then means, under the way that this court has applied the eight corners rule in the past, that if the eight corners rule must apply that way, the ambiguity attaches against us. We are not allowed to contest that ambiguity.
That could be a fraudulent pleading at this point. So there are other remedies available, perhaps.
I do not think that there are any other remedies other than for us to put on the evidence. Otherwise, we are denied any remedy. What we would have to do is defend the case no matter what. And then eventually, at the end of this, it can then be shown that, oh, yes, the accident happened somewhere else. But by the time that happens, State Farm has already been forced to carry on, even though it's known that this accident didn't take place in a place where there was coverage.
File special exceptions.
We cannot file special exceptions. The way that the pleadings work is that somebody has asserted that there's an accident that happened and it caused harm. Filing a special exception, we would not be able to force them to plead where the accident occurred, as far as I can tell, at least.
What about summary judgment?
But we can't file summary judgment. There will be two actions here, just to make this absolutely plain. There's the action involving the lawsuit, and then there's the declaratory judgment action. We can file a summary judgment in the declaratory judgment action, but if the court were to apply the eight corners rule, as has been suggested, we would not be able to talk about any of the evidence that's out there. That's what we did here. We put forward, in the Richards case, we put forward evidence that said, look, the accident happened somewhere else. Look, this person is a member of the insured household and an insured, and therefore the exclusion would happen.
Why not just change the policies? Why not just say it and go to the legislature and avoid all of this and all the uncertainty that arises from bringing in extrinsic evidence that may or may not touch on the merits at that point? Why not just say it?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, why not amend the policies to, as was suggested at the end of opposing counsel's argument?
There are three reasons. The first is that we did amend the policies in this case. We have dropped out the groundless suit clause. Arguably, and certainly our position is that means that we have this coverage, that we have amended sufficiently. More deeply, the question about if this is not adequate, we would like some direction as to what the adequate amendment would be. We need to know that.
Well, and on that point, the Fifth Circuit didn't ask us that, right? Our only jurisdiction over this matter comes from a constitutional provision that authorizes us to answer the certified questions. Do we even, would we be issuing an unconstitutional advisory opinion if we went beyond the question and got into all of this business about whether you can have extrinsic evidence about coverage facts that don't go to the merits and a lot of that that's in the briefing? Isn't that outside of the certified question?
I don't think that it's outside of the certified question because, as I suggested, there's multiple ways of looking at the certified question. You can certainly talk about the rationale. You can also talk about the result. How did B. Hall, what outcome did B. Hall come to? I don't think that you're going past the certified question, particularly because the Fifth Circuit, in its certified question, said any subsidiary or any other issues that you think are appropriate to handle, this court should have, you should have the authority to handle that.
If we agree with your answer, is the whole concept of reservation of rights gone?
No, I do not believe that the entire concept of reservation of rights would be gone. The reason being is we would certainly initially have to defend the case and reserve our rights to seek a declaratory judgment. When the declaratory judgment came out, that would allow us to go forward. I don't think that that changes the...
So you would agree that even if we answered this your way, you would still have a duty to defend up until there's a final court judgment saying you don't?
Yes.
An insurance company could not unilaterally say, we're not going to defend you.
It could, I suppose, at great risk. If it decided that it was going to not provide a defense based on its interpretation of, we think that there's an exclusion here, if the judgment went against the insured and then the insured sued saying, you didn't defend me, you were supposed to, and it was found that we had not done the defense that we were supposed to, there would be great penalties. I think that the proper answer would be, at least the prudent answer for most insurance companies in most cases.
Well, so there'd be great risk if you were wrong, but what I'm getting at is under your theory, you wouldn't have any duty to defend so long as ultimately a court found, based on extrinsic evidence, that there was no coverage.
That is correct. At some point,
insurance companies could, if they were willing to take the risk. I mean, if they got the police report that says the accident occurred in Mexico, and they could just send a letter right off the bat and say, we're not defending you.
Yes, though I still think that the most prudent way to handle that would be a declaratory judgment action saying, we want a declaration. We need to have
sure.
a declaration.
Either sue and say we want a declaration that we don't have to defend, and that's why we're not defending, or just say we're not going to defend and then defend the suit that they file against you if they disagree.
Yes, okay. Either one would be a
possible. But your theory would be that there's no duty to defend at all. If the extrinsic evidence establishes no coverage, there never was a duty.
That's correct. There would never have been a duty because that would have been excluded from the coverage.
You say that the clause was once fairly universal, but has now been dropped, or is more often being dropped from policies. Is that just in Texas, and is there a history behind that?
This is based on my review of various treatises. But my understanding is that it is being dropped more often because the policies are becoming more baroque. I don't have a better word for it. They have more provisions and they are longer than they were. When this process began, and certainly the 1956 treatise that was relied upon in Hayden, those policies were fairly uniform across all states. It's not as uniform as it was. That's not to say that there's still not language. The language sometimes is included, but it's becoming more muddled and less of a one policy fits everywhere in every state.
So given that muddled language and the other general principle that we apply in the insurance context, that as the drafters of the policies, the policy language is strictly construed against the carrier. Why would the omission of this clause upend what is the settled expectation of carriers and insureds about the breadth of the duty to defend?
Because the basis of the clause, the basis of the eight corners rule was in this clause based on Moritz and based on the cases that came after it. If you remove that clause, you have a different contract with different rights and obligations. That's why things would change. If the policies always stayed the same, nothing would change. When you have different policies, you're going to have different processes, is the best way I can put it.
It seems to me the issue is, just from your argument, it's been very enlightening, it's kind of narrowing it down to whether the duty to defend clause that you and I discussed earlier, that you have a duty to defend all claims or suits for damages for which the policy provides coverage, whether that language essentially means the same thing as the groundless, false, or fraudulent clause that you're talking about, that we've been focusing on. So that even in the absence of the groundless, false, or fraudulent clause, the duty to defend clause creates that same obligation. That kind of all comes down to that, doesn't it?
I think so, if I understand your question, but I would phrase it a different way. If the groundless suit clause has no effect, then what you will have done is read out that clause. You would have treated that provision as surplusage and irrelevant.
Not if the duty to defend clause effectively means the same thing. Then we're not writing anything out or in. We're just
I believe you would be taking a provision. I think you still would be writing something out. I think that what you would be saying is that the groundless suit clause is an irrelevancy because the only thing that matters is the duty to defend clause. That certainly has not been the history of Moritz onwards, but that would be what you would be doing.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Schultz.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Knight, you have 5 minutes.
I'd ask you a question. I'm sorry to
certainly
stop. Your client gets sued for causing a car wreck and turns to State Farm and says, please defend this suit, pending in Travis County, Texas. They take the deposition. So they hire a lawyer to represent your client. They take the deposition, and the testimony is that the suit occurred in Mexico. Do they have a right at that point to withdraw their defense?
I do not believe that they do, Your Honor, because that is not what an insured is bargaining for.
I mean, and again, we're assuming that, for the hypothetical, the policy expressly excludes coverage in Mexico, right? So we're halfway through the litigation. I had a product liability case that this happened in. Halfway through the litigation, an expert says, well, the real problem was this piece of the hood of the 18-wheeler, not that piece. And my client had no liability for this piece, so my insurance company said, we're withdrawing the defense. The manufacturer of the hood's got to cover from here on. Your theory is they can't do that.
I don't think so, Your Honor.
They can't withdraw the defense even if the evidence that comes out in discovery disproves coverage.
I don't think so because their ability to withdraw a defense is entirely dependent upon the contract.
Well, and the pleadings.
And the pleadings. Viewing them together, absolutely, if you're going to apply the eight corners rule in the strict narrow sense. So we shouldn't ever be in this scenario. But to be directly responsive to your question, even if we assume that there is no eight corners rule that says this determination as far as an absolute duty to defend from soup to nuts happens at a fixed point in time, everybody understands it, nobody's caught off guard, rug's not pulled out under anybody. Let's say that doesn't exist and talk just about your scenario whereby the policy says you're going to provide me a defense to which coverage applies. And you don't say, to Justice Boyd's question, you don't say, but beware, this is contingent upon there not being any extrinsic evidence discovered, and it doesn't have to be this specific, but I think you'll take my meaning, discovered in a deposition that demonstrates that the accident actually occurred in New Mexico as to wherever. You don't even have to say that. You could just say, But if during the course of the litigation or the investigation, extrinsic evidence demonstrates that an exclusion, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, there are clean and efficient ways in which an insurer...
In the real world, that, I mean, I'm just thinking back on my part, don't insurance companies withdraw their defense all the time when evidence comes out that conclusively establishes lack of coverage? Sure seems like that happens.
That perhaps may be the case, but when that occurs, there is still a context in which the insured could take issue with that. Yeah. If we are going to formulate a rule that says you now have the absolute right, independent of any doctrine under Texas law, to do that to me, and how could we then have the current paradigm where I have a right to recourse? Because the court has just said in absolutes, you can do this to me. And so I think that's what's problematic about that scenario. If I could very briefly take up a couple of points. Justice Heck asked about whether or not the groundless false or fraudulent coverage provision in some other jurisdiction is being dropped. Perhaps it is, but what is telling in that regard, I don't know of any other jurisdiction that has said, by virtue of that language being dropped, we're now opening up the floodgates for extrinsic evidence. So even though this language may not be common anymore, the jurisprudence of other states, consistent with the jurisprudence of this state, is what happened here should not have happened. And I think that that directly relates to the notion of, as Mr. Schultz put it, where did the doctrine come from? It came from, I think, a recognition that we should not be doing this kind of effort for the benefit of someone who at the outset could have drafted a policy of insurance in any number of ways to have preempted this issue. So if a policy language exception one day is considered or contemplated by this court, it should occur in the context of a case in which the insurer has put it at issue, but for purposes of stare decisis, that has not occurred here.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Knight. The case is submitted. That concludes the arguments, and the case is set for this morning, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, now stands adjourned.